Does concussion have any impact on IQ in kids?
Affecting RNA to treat hypertension.
Do hearing aids help with regard to the development of dementia?
And is it healthy to be a weekend warrior?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
So, Rick, I would like to turn first to the New England Journal, if you're okay with that. This hormone, angiotensinogen, and gosh, what's it have to do with hypertension?
Well, Elizabeth, it has a lot to do with hypertension. Angiotensinogen is actually made in the liver, and it's processed by a number of different enzymes, renin and angiotensin-converting enzymes. And these particular compounds are responsible for retaining water and causing constriction of the blood vessels, all of which can increase blood pressure. So we have things like ACE inhibitors, and angiotensin receptor blockers that are currently on the market to address this. But this is a novel way of addressing not the subsequent products of the pathway, but the angiotensinogen. And what this is, it's a study using RNA interference to affect the production of angiotensinogen at the level of the liver. What RNA interference does is it attaches small pieces of RNA to a molecule. The molecule enters the liver, and it prevents the production of angiotensinogen. So the protein's really never made. And in this particular study, a phase one study, so it's an initial dosing study, where they use doses as little as 10 to as much as 800 milligrams. By the way, it's injected. It's followed for 4 weeks and up to 24 weeks to see, A, whether it causes reduction of the protein, is it safe, and more importantly, can it reduce blood pressure? What it did show is that it effectively reduces angiotensinogen production by more than 90%. And in people with hypertension, it lowered their blood pressure substantially, even 24 weeks after a single injection. And more specifically, it lowered the systolic blood pressure by more than 20 millimeters and the diastolic pressure by more than 10 millimeters. By the way, there weren't any serious side effects in the 107 patients in whom the drug was tested.
This sounds, of course, like really great news. And I guess I would just call out that RNAs, they are just the darlings of research right now, aren't they? All the different types that we have out there that we ignored for a very long time. So let's talk a little bit about something we started to talk about before we were recording, which is, gosh, angiotensinogen. I'm just guessing that once we knock it out, we're going to find out that there's more to that cat than we thought.
Well, we've already knocked out some of the other products in the pathway, and we know that if we give too much, it can cause hypotension or low blood pressure. It can cause elevated potassium. As you noted, this is a small study in a small number of patients, none of whom had significant comorbid disease. These are relatively, quote, healthy people with hypertension. But for proof of concept, I think it's very good. To be able to give a one-time injection and have reduction in blood pressure over the course of 24 weeks is pretty impressive. Now, as you mentioned, sometimes that may be harmful in some other conditions. So there's really a lot more we need to discover about this particular drug.
Let's turn from here to the Lancet. This is a Johns Hopkins study, actually, by my friend and colleague, Frank Lin et al. And this is taking a look at what Frank has been working on for many, many, many years. It's something that's called the ACHIEVE study, a multi-center parallel group, unmasked, randomized controlled trial of adults who were between 70 and 84 years of age with untreated hearing loss and without substantial cognitive impairment at the time that they were enrolled in the study. And this took place at four community study sites across the U.S. They ended up randomly assigning 490 people to a hearing intervention and 487 to a health education control group. There were two groups of folks who were represented in this. Those who are already part of a study that's been ongoing for quite a while looking at cardiovascular health called the ERIC study, the Atherosclerosis Risk in Communities study. And then they also recruited what they called healthy de novo or new community volunteers. And there were folks of both of those groups who were in each of the groups, the intervention group and in the health education group. In the intervention group, they were assessed and then they were given hearing aids. And then in the health education group, they basically had education. They followed these folks out to see whether or not there were any differences in their three-year cognitive decline. And the answer was, oh no, in spite of the fact that some folks were using hearing aids, it did not reduce their cognitive decline in the 3 years that they were followed. However, in those adults who were at risk for cognitive decline, a sub-analysis seems to suggest that it might be helpful.
As you mentioned, in the overall analysis, the total cohort, it combined both study groups. It showed no effect, but there was a 50% reduction in global cognitive decline in the ERIC cohort. Now, the ERIC cohort, they had more risk factors for cognitive decline and dementia. They had lower baseline cognitive scores and a faster rate of decline. So this suggests that the hearing intervention might differ in its effect. If people are at low risk, then it's probably not very helpful. But in individuals that are older at increased risk, it might have a very important effect. We know that dementia is increasing worldwide, especially in low and middle income countries, and we're looking at ways of preventing it or modifying it that are really cost effective. This shows that addressing hearing issues, especially in the highest risk individuals, may be most helpful.
I just have to wonder whether waiting for people to be at risk is really a good strategy for prevention.
The study would suggest that people that aren't at high risk or have a low rate of decline, it's really not going to be very helpful. Therefore, you're basically applying a treatment that really doesn't change the outcome of a particular group. And that's why I think this particular study is really informative.
It seems to me that people who are experiencing hearing loss experience an improved quality of life when their hearing is bolstered by hearing aids.
That's an important point, but a different outcome. If you can show that the hearing intervention improves their quality of life, then you can target those individuals in whom they have experienced a decrease in quality of life and want to improve it.
Let's turn to JAMA. Gosh, if you are a weekend warrior, are you putting yourself at risk?
I'm really glad they did this study because when we look at the exercise recommendations, for many of us, it's hard to meet them. So for example, we know that the guidelines recommend 150 minutes or more of moderate to vigorous physical activity per week to receive an overall robust health benefit. Now, let me take a step back and say that any amount of exercise is helpful. So even individuals that can't do 150 minutes shouldn't be discouraged. Whatever you can do, it's more important to be active than to sit. But for those of us that really want to try to meet the deadline and have a very busy job, we can't actually do 30 minutes of exercise 5 days per week. So the question is doing this weekend warrior where you concentrate all your activity in 1 or 2 days as beneficial as spreading it out over the course of the week? They looked at almost 90,000 individuals that were in the UK Biobank cohort study. A significant number of those actually had accelerated-based physical activity data. So they wore a tracker and we can tell when they exercised. And of these 90,000 individuals, about a third of them were inactive. But of the two-thirds that were active, most of them were actually weekend warriors. About two-thirds of those were weekend warriors, and a third of those provided regular activity that was spread out through the entire week. And then when they looked at the incidence of acute atrial fibrillation, heart attack, heart failure, or stroke, what they noticed is that there were similar declines in each of those, regardless of whether someone was a weekend warrior or whether they stretched the activity out through an entire week. And by the way, all of those were substantially decreased by 20 to 40% compared to those people that were inactive.
Okay, so this is all moving into no excuses, because the other thing that we, of course, have noticed about physical activity is that even if all you do is get up and move for 5 minutes at a time, 6 times during the day, that also results in significant benefits.
Absolutely. I mean, if you just even do a half or a third of the activity that's recommended, you can still decrease these outcomes by 30 or 40%. So doing something is more important than doing nothing. It doesn't have to be done every day of the week. So people can find the rhythm that best suits them. There are some individuals that want to do it every day of the week because it maintains that consistency. It's easier for them to do it and they have the time. But individuals like me, I can concentrate on 1 or 2 days a week and still get the same outcome. That's great news.
Yeah, for you, that's of course great news. Finally, let's turn to the journal Pediatrics. And this is a look at IQ after pediatric concussion. We've been doing an awful lot of talking about concussion and about its deleterious impacts. And in this study, they had 866 children between the ages of 8 and almost 17 years of age. And they were recruited from 2 prospective cohort studies from emergency departments, both in the United States and in Canada. They were recruited sometime in the 48 hours after sustaining their concussion, or they had a control group that had orthopedic injury. And in the United States, they administered IQ tests and performance validity testing post-acutely 3 to 18 days after their injury, or 3 months post-injury in Canada. They took a look at IQ scores and they examined them with three different statistical approaches. What they found, and this should make everybody feel really happy, is that there were no clinically meaningful differences in IQ scores after pediatric concussion.
This is a hard study to do, because if you want to do it in the most rigorous way, you do IQ test on all the kids before they have their concussion and IQ test on them afterwards. But then you got to know which kids are going to have a concussion. So the investigators, realizing that couldn't be done, they compared kids that had a concussion versus kids that also had sports injuries, orthopedic injuries, but without a concussion. And as you mentioned, there was no meaningful difference in IQ either short term, as within days or months afterwards. Now, we're not advocating for a concussion, but it is a little reassuring to know that, at least in these cohort studies, that there's not a meaningful difference in IQ for kids that have concussions. This is considered mild traumatic brain injury, not moderate or severe, because we know that can affect both neurodevelopment and IQ. For these mild traumatic brain injuries, it doesn't appear to significantly affect IQ.
Right. Now, I would also note that just today, there was a study that was undertaken by the British Football Associations, aka soccer, taking a look at repeatedly heading a ball and whether that ultimately impacted. And they did find that there was a problem. So once again, back to a single mild concussion may not be problematic in the long term, but repeated injury for sure is something that we really need to pay attention to.
And in the sports world, that chronic encephalopathy can develop with repetitive severe head injuries.
On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up, make healthy choices.